Our third presentation today is addressing barriers to housing and healthcare. It's a different title. Addressing barriers to housing and healthcare for chronically homeless with state and local partnerships in New York City, or how can we make health homes work for the homeless? Lessons from New York City's HHC's Chronic Illness Demonstration Project. Our presenter today is Ryan McCormick. I have a little bio for him. Ryan McCormick is an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Bellevue Hospital Center of the NYU School of Medicine. He is board certified in emergency medicine, internal medicine, and addiction medicine. In addition to his clinical responsibilities, he directs the Chronic Public Inebriates Initiative, which addresses the care of chronically homeless, high utilizers of healthcare services with alcohol use disorders, and is the principal investigator of the NIDA-funded multi-center trial of screening, motivational assessment, referral, and treatment for drug use in the emergency department.
Hi, thank you. So, Maria Raven, the hospital home is directed by Maria Raven, and she couldn't be here today, unfortunately. So I'll be speaking on her behalf, and as well as the Supporting Housing Network of New York. Good morning. We have no disclosures, although I did borrow this tie today. I thought it was orange, so I was trying to be appropriate for Halloween. To start with a little background on hospital to home, it is a State Department of Health funded chronic illness demonstration project, one of six in New York. The key components of it are providing intensive care management and coordination of services for a population of Medicaid-insured patients who are, through modeling, high risk for frequent hospitalizations. The project occurs in three hospitals. Bellevue is where I work, and also Woodhull and Elmhurst are the other two hospitals. And enrollment has been occurring for about 2 years, with 540 patients enrolled so far, and currently there are 368 patients currently enrolled. As you can see, about half of them are homeless or precariously housed. And this is just a schematic of how the process works. It starts with outreach and enrollment, and then performing a needs assessment and developing action plans through social work and care management teams, and through motivational interviewing. And then a bundle of services are provided to really provide wraparound care. There is coordination with discharge planning and medical care linkages. Patients are provided cell phones with the support staff's contact numbers and other tangible things like alarm clocks to help keep organized. Benefits help significant efforts in housing and other support measures. And this is a description of the homelessness of the population. The pilot work showed that about half of the patients would be precariously housed or homeless, which brings into light the importance of having connections with the housing organizations. It's clearly a priority, and also a recognition that homeless patients, as has been talked about here today, have different priorities and use healthcare differently. And the full-time housing coordinator that exists has placed 90 referrals, and the pie chart there shows where the patients are in that process. And over 52 housing applications have been submitted at this time, so it's quite a bit of work. The traditionally, the healthcare system and the housing systems have not been playing in the sandbox together, and it's an unfortunate recognition because as defined by this patient population being high utilizers, they are the healthcare system is a point of entry, but it's underutilized as an intervention point. And so that's a focus here. I mean, it's the focus of the talk, the need for partnerships. And so these partnerships help to improve communication, reduce care fragmentation, improve outcomes, and it's the poor planning that and communication that is thought to lead to some of the preventable readmissions, rising healthcare costs, and poor outcomes, which can obviously include death in this vulnerable population. And as others have mentioned today, that housing and survival is a priority for homeless patients where healthcare may take a back burner. And briefly, just use as a case example, Miss W. She has medical, psychiatric, and addiction problems. Was at frequent hospitalizations for uncontrolled diabetes. After enrollment, she received the services that we talked about, a lot of support, smoking cessation. Mentioned that, the mention of your study, and a lot of just intensive care and support. And on the bottom here, in 6 months pre-enrollment, or no, 12 months pre-enrollment, she had 3 hospitalizations. Then after enrollment, 1 hospitalization. So that was accounted for a $60,000 savings in Medicaid alone. Did I go too many? So looking at which benefits are thought to help the homeless population, the mobile phone technology, the care manager's phone numbers are included in there, and aggressive efforts to help with the housing application, which is an arduous process, the partnerships that allow bidirectional data sharing, trying to track patients longitudinally for, and managing, helping the patients manage their problems and So, and then there's group meetings for the particularly difficult clients or patients. The team meets and tries to problem solve and help collaborate in that sense. I'm just gonna hit that. So this is the 6 months pre and post enrollment. This is just the average numbers for 52 patients, and you can see that that accounts to a 20% Medicaid savings, which is $855 a month. And the source of that savings is primarily in the reduction of inpatient and emergency. I've been practicing with paper. I didn't. Maria's slides are more sophisticated than mine. But the reduction is about a 50% reduction in the emergency and inpatient stays, which accounts to a lesser percentage in the cost, but it's quite remarkable. And we'll finish the hospital home slides with how these savings could be applied. And the Medicaid savings alone really offset almost entirely the annual cost of supportive housing. So it's really remarkable, and that's just talking about finances. So next we're going to go to a project that I lead that is largely inspired by a hospital to home, and a lot of the Maria was my kind of day-to-day mentor, and we shared an office, so I heard about all these things, and it just helped me develop this, as did she. I'm going to start with a case example. I hate to use the word case, a patient. In January of 2009, Fred was found on a New York City sidewalk, minimally responsive, with presumed intoxication, wearing urine-soaked garments. Shortly thereafter, he was brought to the emergency department where he, after a prolonged resuscitation, was pronounced dead of hypothermia. A year prior, he had been admitted to the ICU with hypothermia, was intubated, and had a 2-week hospitalization that was quite complicated. And he had a total of 9 ICU admissions, 500 emergency department visits, and a dozen or so other inpatient stays for detoxification and other medical complications. And that was by the time of his death, when he was 32 years old. And those stays are to Bellevue alone. And this is in New York, so probably more than half of his visits were to outside hospitals. He was really loved by our staff and well-known. And there was an outcry to do something. And the something is really a word that kind of sticks with me because nobody really knew what to do. And I was pretty much, that was directed to me because I was already doing alcohol and research. And so the title of this project, Chronic Public Inebriate Initiative, I don't really think it's the best term. I took it from Housing First literature, and I'm hoping to change it. And I think one of the things is it doesn't really account for the comorbidities in a great way, because it's I'm just going to leave it there. These patients are more than just chronically intoxicated. So I'm talking about the chronically homeless, not just the homeless, and people on the severe end of the spectrum of alcohol use disorders. In the literature where Housing First studies, and the population has not been well defined. It's been a lot of self-referrals, but those are the basic ideas, and it hasn't been very well standardized otherwise. So these are some of the goals: to facilitate access to healthcare and adherence to their healthcare, and also access to supportive services, primarily housing. And I saw things like the Maria and others hospital home program, read through the Housing First literature, and saw these areas where there was success and tried to translate them into this for use in this population. And also in the last couple of decades, there's a tremendous amount of understanding that's come about through neuroimaging and other science about the understanding and treatment of addiction. And so I wanted to incorporate some of that. And there needs to be a paradigm shift in the way that we treat patients. We repeatedly see patients come in intoxicated, and when they're able to walk and walk without falling, they leave the department, and this happens every day, and nothing happens, and it's just a miserable existence, and it's really quite sad. And that's in addition to Fred's death. I've seen 10 of the top 50 patients die on my list in the last 3 years. And it's just a miserable existence to see, and it's a big motivator. And then there are some policy things that I'm not going to get into too much, but one of them is trying to dissolve the barriers to data sharing, because it has been a big hurdle here. And maybe to decrease fragmented care, try to give patients an emergency department home so they can be not always taken to it. I mean, they might need to go to the nearest emergency department, but maybe have a prioritized emergency department. And all of this requires partnerships, which is the reason why we're here today, mostly. And these are some of the partnerships. It's just an amazing, it was an amazing thing. We called a meeting, and Catherine and I were talking about it last night. I mean, there were so many people I didn't even realize I had met Catherine 2 years ago when this started. I mean, within HHC, which is the Health and Hospitals Corporation, the public health hospitals in New York, but within Bellevue and NYU School of Medicine, we had the chairs and other representatives from the Department of Emergency Medicine, Psychiatry, Toxicology, Internal Medicine, Social Work, Care Management. There was legal, other administrators within Bellevue and the central HHC. Department of Homeless Services has been amazing, and their outreach teams, Manhattan Outreach, they've been our key partners. We've also been working with Department of Health, FDNY, EMS. I still haven't gotten my hat yet, which I would like to be able to disclose. And we're trying to have linkages with community-based providers and detoxification centers. And then we have Lily, who was an intern while she was a medical student. Not a medical student. Sorry, she's not going to medical school anymore. She has been disillusioned by the bad care that we provide. She was a student at NYU, an individualized study, and we've had other interns. This has been completely unfunded, so it's been a voluntary effort based on people's altruism and just concern for this patient population. This is an overview of the process. So it starts off with identifying patients, and we did this through certainly I asked for people to refer people names, and We also did a database search through administrative records to identify, and that was to the most frequent visitors to the emergency department with at least one diagnosis that was alcohol related, and that's how we started the database search. And then we did these exhaustive chart reviews. And ideally at this point, we would share our potential list with Department of Homeless Services, but legal data sharing barriers got prevent that. And so now when the patients come to the emergency department, we consent them when they're able to be consented and share that information with Department of Homeless Services. They run it against their database, confirm their homeless history, and on the subsequent visits or in the streets, because we get some data to try to locate them, they intervene at that point. And in real time, they come to the emergency department through a special initiative, and they bring patients to support to some kind of, not shelter necessarily, but some kind of supportive housing or transitional housing. And then we enact these action plans that we developed largely through their chart reviews based on their needs and their lack of assessments. If they've never had a psychiatric assessment, they need a full one. And also with the talking, we have weekly meetings with, now bi-weekly meetings with Department of Homeless Services and the other partners to keep that dynamic. And this is just from the chart review, just to give you an idea of the number of visits. So I only included patients with 10 or more visits a year to the emergency department, and that is just between 10 and 19 in a year is almost 150 patients. And above that, it goes into, I think the next group is thousands. I mean, it's definitely exponential. So this is what we're looking at. We're looking at the sickest, the most frequent visitors. And here are some early outcomes. This project has not been going on very long. And of the patients placed, they're broken down. There's a lot going on this slide. And of the patients that have been placed for at least 3 months, and then patients that have been placed for 6 to 12 months are broken down here. And so the first is the emergency department, and CPAP is emergency psychiatry. And then the next group is inpatient visits. So you can see before they were enrolled, they had about 3 emergency department visits. This is per month, per person, and then afterwards it dropped. And the drop in utilization is somewhere between 39 and 50, is around 40 to 50%. Now those numbers this is very preliminary, and it's one hospital, and so I don't want, but it's quite dramatic and wonderful. And then just some financial data. The pilot patients, the 20 patients in our pilot, their hospital charge per year has been about $40,000 for the last 3 years. And then we're just looking at different ways to identify the most in need patients. And so patients with 10 or more visits for 2 consecutive years, that was 43 patients. And their charges were $64,000, and about a little more than half of that was what the payment was received. And they have 58 visits, or they have 58 days in the hospital per year on average. And that includes the number of emergency department visits and plus the days that they were hospitalized. And of the original database search of 500 patients, a little over 500 patients, they were 17 days per year. So this top 10, the 10 for 2 years seems to be pretty helpful. And this is the last slide, and this is these are the placements so far. So we have 16 placed. The one who's in permanent housing hundreds of visits before placement, and since his placement about 6 months ago, he has had no emergency department visits, and he has gone to, he is able to be on Coumadin now because he follows up, and he's gone to Coumadin Clinic every week, and it's just amazing. So many thanks. The left-hand column, what we're on Maria's slides, and I'd just like to thank the social work, everybody that I've mentioned, especially Department of Homeless Services and social work. A lot of people. And I really want to thank you three for coming. That's really great. Four. I'm sorry. Four.
Thank you.
Thank you.